listening to TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Now, the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And before I bring up today's guest, I'd like to thank Julie and Wesley for their recent donations. Thank you so much for supporting the show and helping me to finance the show. And today, we're continuing with our past, present and future series. We've done shows on Russia, Libya, Fukushima and the surveillance state. And I'm delighted to have on today an absolute expert on the South African issue. I've heard her on Jeff Wentz's show several times. She's an excellent guest with an excellent presentation. She's also got her own radio show. Her name is Karen Smith and I'm going to bring her up right now. Karen, are you with me?
I'm here, Andy.
That's great. It's great to have you on board. And as I say, it's quite, we've been talking. We had a great conversation before the show. Really enjoyed that. And it was really trying to, because obviously past, present and future South Africa terms, it's very difficult to get the whole South African story into an hour. But as you know, I've done shows, for example, I did an extensive show on the Boer Wars with Stephen Mitford-Goodson. And so really, I know that you want to start us off with a couple of points you need to quantify, and then we'll jump into the past, present and future of South Africa from your perspective. So also, before you go into that, can you let the listeners know of any websites, how they can get your radio show, etc.?
My website is radiofreesouthafrica.com, as is my YouTube. I have a page on Facebook, also Radio Free South Africa. And you can contact me via my website, info@radiofreesouthafrica.com.
Excellent. So I wanted to get that in so that people can go directly and listen to some of your shows, look at some of your YouTubes, your website, etc. So, right, let's go ahead with the show. If you can run us through, I always ask the guests to run through in as great or as little a detail as they would like. So if you can start us off with a couple of points to set the scene for your past, present and future of South Africa show, and then jump into the past section and we'll go from there.
Great. Thank you very much, Andy. So I'm not going to go through the whole history of the Boers from 1652 onwards because you've covered that in previous shows. But I would like to just stress a couple of points that will make the present more sense, more reasonable to people. One of the things that is very important to know about South Africa is that when the Dutch landed at the Cape in 1652, there were no noble black savages to be seen. The only other color race of people that inhabited the Cape at the time when Jan van Riebeck landed were the Khoisan. Now, some people know them as Bushmen because they've seen that The Gods Must Be Crazy movie, and they know them as Bushmen. These people are not African at all. They speak a completely different language, none of the Negroid languages at all. They speak in clicks and whistles. They're small people, small of stature. They're a different color. They're kind of a yellowy orange color. And their anthropological past goes back way, way further in the Cape than any black person. So it's important to know that there were no blacks inhabiting the southern half of southern Africa when the white people landed. It was only 120 years later that the whites met up with the what we consider black people at the Fish River when they were trekking north and the blacks were coming south. So, and at that time, there was no Zulu nation that hadn't been formed yet. There were blacks coming from up north, and they were killing all the tribes in their path. It's called the Mafokane or the Defokane, where they slaughtered. We don't know how many because they don't have numbers that reach that high. But tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, of black tribes on their way south. So those are important facts before we even start. I'm going to go past the Voortrekkers, I'm going to go past the Boer War, and I'm going to lead up to the apartheid era. Now, what people consider apartheid to be was that it was formed by the Afrikaner and that they brought in these laws against the blacks and made their lives miserable, oppressed and killed hundreds of thousands of them. All lies. The British in 1902, after the Boer Wars, they started the apartheid laws. They brought in the laws that said no mixed marriages, blacks may not own property, blacks may not vote, blacks must live in their own homelands. It was the British who started apartheid, but it did not have a name. So in 1948, when the National Party got political power in South Africa, we were still under British rule, but we had an Afrikaner parliament, and they still had to live by the British laws. And people don't understand that at all. In 1960s, when we got independence from Britain, then we tightened up the apartheid laws as a matter of sheer self-defense. There were more blacks than there were ever whites in South Africa. And in order to protect ourselves as a nation, we imposed laws. For instance, they had to carry a passbook. Areas were white by night, and if blacks were found in that area at night, without a passbook and without reason to be there, they would be put in jail. Now, whether that was right or wrong is not my place to judge. That's how things were done in those days, and the political consciousness has changed a lot since then. So you cannot judge those days by the way that we think today. Things were very different then. Anyway, President Verwoerd wanted to have a thing called grand apartheid, which essentially apartheid means separateness. He wanted separate development for all peoples. Self-rule, self-determination, separate development. He wanted the Zulus to live in Zululand, the Vendors to live in Vendorland, the Swanas to live in Botswana, etc. He wanted each group of people to have their own place to live with their own chiefs, their own ethics, their own morals, their own laws, because the black tribes are famous for fighting each other. And he did not want any part of that. And so the word apartheid was formed. And it is not what people think it is today. It is separate development. And the white taxpayer paid for the development of these separate countries for the blacks. They gave them running water, electricity, schools, universities, airports, hospitals. All of those things were given to the blacks by the white taxpayer. And but there were very few of us. I mean, there were never more than 6 million whites in South Africa. And during the 50 years of apartheid, the black population grew by 920%. Now, if the stories of the horrors of apartheid and the murders by the whites, etc., were true, why did so many blacks want a part of this civilized nation? It doesn't make sense to me that the world still today thinks that a white South African is essentially a murderer of blacks because of apartheid. It just doesn't make sense when you look at the enormous growth in the black population in during that time. Anyway, so we get kind of through of the apartheid era to Nelson Mandela, who is a saint for most of the world. There are statues to him everywhere. His funeral was attended by dignitaries from every country who mourned the passing of this wonderful, peaceful man. Now, Mandela was a terrorist. He was a murderer, and he was an awful, awful person. At his trial, he was accused of 170-plus crimes, which he did not dispute, about 154 of them. He did not dispute. He did not dispute treason. He did not dispute murder. He did not dispute violence. He was accused of these crimes, and then his people asked Amnesty International, which is a very, very left-leaning liberal group, to defend him at his trial. And even they said they could not do it because this man was a violent murderer and they could not defend him. So at his trial in any other country, he would have been shot at dawn, hanged at midnight, or disposed of in some way. But the South African government did not want to make a martyr of him, which in my opinion was a terrible mistake, because they sent him to jail for life. And he became a living symbol of oppression while he was in jail. So the rest of the world decided that we were terrible, terrible people, the whites of South Africa. Now, Andy, I'm not justifying apartheid. And I'm not saying that terrible crimes were not committed, because in any race of people, there are horrible human beings who do horrible things. And if you give people power, they tend to abuse it. So I am not saying that there were not injustices and that blacks were not treated badly. I am not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that the injustices that the blacks and the rest of the world screamed about were certainly not as bad as they were made out to be. Because during the apartheid years, the rate of murders were approximately 7,000 per year, approximately. And now they're up to 135,000 per year under the black ANC government. And that 7,000 was mainly black on black. It was not whites killing blacks wholesale until the streets ran with blood. And the world, I think that that may have been the beginning of political correctness when they turned on South Africa and said, if we don't change our ways immediately, they're going to institute sanctions against us. They did the sanctions.
It's interesting. Sorry to jump in, Karen. The only reason I've jumped in here is because you mentioned these black-on-black killings. And in my book, Synagogue of Satan Updated, Expanded and Uncensored, in 1995, I've got down that the ANC set up the Truth and Reconciliations Commission, headed up by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, which was instructed to investigate alleged crimes of the apartheid regime. Interestingly, yes, this commission discovers that whilst the apartheid regime were responsible for the deaths of 500 of their black political opponents over the years, the ANC were responsible for the deaths of 22,000 of their black political opponents, nearly 50 times more than the so-called oppressive regime, and of their fellow blacks.
Exactly. But Andy, the world is not made cognizant of those facts. Because if you speak to anybody anywhere about apartheid, it was mass murder of the by whites on blacks, which is, you've just proven it. It was a ANC-controlled black commission that did this investigation. And their own findings prove that the stories about apartheid are lies. These are not white people covering up the facts. It's a black commission saying, but this didn't happen. And yet, even in South Africa, the blacks are not aware of that because it's not politically correct and it doesn't fit the narrative. So you don't present facts. You just tell a lie, and if you tell it often enough, it's accepted as truth. And so every single white South African is painted with this brush of being a racist murderer, which is far from the truth. So I'm very glad you came in and stated those facts, because I don't have those numbers at my fingertips right now. And you know, if I say one figure incorrectly, that then negates the entire story of what I'm telling you. So I'm very careful not to give wrong figures. Anyway, so the apartheid era. The red line to lifting sanctions against South Africa was, for the Americans, the freeing of Nelson Mandela. So in 1985, the president of South Africa said to Mandela, "We will give you unconditional release from prison if you renounce violence." And Mandela said, "I can't do that. I'm not renouncing violence." So he was kept in prison. Now, yes, for some of his years in prison, he was in prison 27 years, 17 of which he was on Robben Island. And the rest, some of them he was in Polsmoor Prison. And the final years of his imprisonment were spent in what is called a bungalow on the grounds of the prison. He had this beautiful house with a valet, a butler, a swimming pool, a pool table, a chef. He entertained dignitaries from all over the world in this awful prison cell of his, poor man. I would love to live in my normal life the way he lived in prison in his final years. But until the end, when we released him, he refused to renounce violence, and also wrote a book called How to Be a Good Communist while he was in prison. And the ANC, up to Mandela's death, said he was never a communist. It was never part of his makeup. Well, then I don't understand how his book came to be. However, and another thing I want to mention about Mandela, in this awful apartheid era where we oppressed the blacks, he got his university education at the University of Fort Hare, which was a black university funded by the whites, and he became a lawyer, as did Mahatma Gandhi become a lawyer during the dreaded apartheid regime. So it couldn't have been that awful if we produced these well-educated black people from white-funded black universities. I just want to show the lies that people have been told about apartheid and believe them to this very day. It's shocking to me that they don't investigate or find the truth of the matter when so much information is available on the internet today. Anyway, we released Mandela, and in 1992, the government came to the whites of South Africa, who were the only ones who had a vote at that stage. Blacks were not allowed to vote. And they said, "We are going to have a referendum which you can vote on." And the question that they asked was, should the nationalist government continue negotiations with the ANC about peace and leading to power sharing? Now, the white population of South Africa was tired of internal wars, the wars on our borders with the Cubans and the Russians, the internal unrest, the constant bombing of restaurants, police stations, railway stations. They were weary of sending their sons out to die or be crippled in some way by war. And we voted overwhelmingly that we should continue negotiations with the ANC. Well, before we could blink, the ANC was in control in 1994. There was no such thing as power sharings. The whites then had no voice, being an absolute tiny minority. The figures that we estimate of the population of South Africa today, and these are only estimates because they have not taken a census, we don't know, but we estimate 70 million people live in South Africa, of which 3.5 to 4 million are white people. So we are hugely outnumbered, don't have the possibility of having a voice in parliament, and suddenly our lives turned around and became worth nothing. One of the first things that the ANC did was to disarm the white population. They said, now, under the Nationalist Party government, when you bought a firearm, you had to get a license for it. So you would go into the gun store, decide which firearm you wanted, pay for it, and apply for a license for that firearm. So when the ANC took over, they had this neat database of firearm owners, where they lived, how many firearms they had, and where they kept them. And they said that we had to return our firearms to our closest police station, where they would keep them in gun safes until such time as we got a new license issued by the new government, and then we would get our firearm back from the police station. So, like real good little robots, law-abiding citizens, most people went and handed in their firearms, never to see them again. Because getting a firearm license out of the ANC government is an absolute nightmare. And they keep tightening up the laws so that it becomes impossible for you to get one. So those firearms which we have handed in, like law-abiding citizens, to the police stations, have now been sold to criminals, have disappeared by their tens of thousands. And in South Africa today, at some police stations, you can go and rent a firearm for about $5 a day. So if you think that those police are renting firearms out to law-abiding citizens, then I've got a farm to sell you in the middle of the swamp in Florida. I mean, you know, it's an impossible to believe that the police think that they're renting firearms for what?
Isn't it interesting, Karen, that one of the key features of communism is disarming the population?
Yes, and that was their very first action. Their first action was to disarm us. And we had a group called the Commandos, which were normal citizens who defended the farms, because farms in South Africa, because of the nature of the terrain and the harshness of the climate, farms are enormous and very isolated. So we had a commando corps that defended the farmers and kept the farms safe. Well, that was disbanded also immediately. So the farmers are now disarmed and they don't have the commando corps to protect them. So they are sitting ducks for what is to come next. So then the ANC decided that we needed affirmative action laws to bring into the workforce the blacks who had been excluded from it to a very big extent during the apartheid years. Now, during the apartheid years, there were laws that kept jobs for white people so that whites were not unemployed. Unemployment was very small amongst the whites, and there was job reservation. So blue-collar jobs were reserved for white people. I am not commenting on the wrongs and rights of that, but affirmative action seemed pretty fair to bring the majority into the workforce to give them opportunities which they definitely did not have under the apartheid regime. But affirmative action was not good enough for the ANC. We then had black economic empowerment. Now, today that has become broad-based black economic empowerment. And those laws state that every company's workforce must match the population in that area. In other words, there are 80% black people. So your company from bottom to top must be 80% black, and a certain percent colored, and a certain percent Indian, and about 2% white. So what happened during that time was that the whites who had management experience, etc., were all fired, put out to pasture, and replaced with blacks who had not worked their way through the company and did not have, in general, did not have the qualifications to run that job. But even that was not good enough for the AMC. They then decided that every company must be 51% black owned. And they are now trying to make it 70% black owned. So what happened there was that if you had your own company, you had to have a black partner, whether he was qualified or not, you had to have him. Whether he worked in the company or not, you had to have him. And you had to give, not sell, give 51% of your company away. The result of this was that millions of, well, hundreds of thousands of white people then had no job and no way ever to get a job again, because there's so few of us, and we couldn't get a job anywhere because of the numbers game that they play in companies in South Africa. Now, you can imagine, Andy, if you're a middle management or top management in a company, you have a nice house, you have a mortgage on your house, you have a car, your wife has a car, your kids are at good schools, and suddenly you are out of work, certain to never be in the workforce again. What is going to happen to you and your family? You run through your savings, you stop paying your mortgage, your cars are repossessed, your home is repossessed, you are on the street with your family. Now, what do you do? Because the South African government does not have a safety net for whites. Black people get child support, child grants, social security grants, medical grants, etc. White people do not. So, what do? You're on the streets, and the streets are a very dangerous place for whites in South Africa. I'll get to the murder rate in a moment. But so you and your family, who are middle-class workers, now are bereft of a chance at life. Now, in South Africa, I don't know what it's like in the UK, but in South Africa, you pay school fees, you have to wear a uniform, you have to buy your own books, and you have to provide your transport to and from school. Now, a family that are living under a bridge somewhere obviously cannot do that. So your children are not being educated, and you are struggling for a roof over your head, a place to sleep warm at night, and where's your next meal coming from? Now, at this stage, after 22 years of ANC rule, we believe that between 800,000 and 1 million whites are in this situation, mostly through no fault of their own. There are always those people in any group of people who refuse to work, who are on drugs, who are alcoholics, who are whatever, and sort of sleep under bridges by default because they don't want to do anything with their lives or are incapable of doing anything with their lives. But these people are people who have worked their entire lives, lost their jobs through no fault of their own, only because of their skin color, and now have no future whatsoever. None, because they will never get a job again. So what happened was they started banding together because there is a ephemeral, I think, safety in numbers. There isn't really one, but you feel better if there's more than just your little family hanging out there under a bridge. So they started banding together, these groups of white people, and forming informal settlements. They call them squatter camps, but by law in South Africa, a squatter camp is only designated as such if it is allowed by the government. And as far as I know, there are only two government-approved white squatter camps in South Africa, but there are probably 800 informal white settlements in South Africa. Now, a lot of these settlements are on farmland provided by a sympathetic white person who has an empty piece of land. But a lot of those demand a rental for your piece of land where you're going to squat. So they don't provide running water, they don't provide toilets, they don't provide anything except the bare land. These houses, the shacks that are built on them, are made of road signs, cardboard boxes, pieces of corrugated iron, whatever they can find to keep the weather off. So they are unsafe. They have no amenities. They have no electricity, no running water, no toilets. But they feel safer because they are banded together with other people in the same situation. Now, if there are only 3.5 million whites in South Africa, and close to a million and rising every day of them are in these settlements, that is a third of the white population. And we estimated recently that there are over 300,000 children in these settlements. Now, these children don't know where their next meal is coming from. They are suffering from mental and developmental problems because they don't get regular meals and the necessary things for children's growth. And they are also missing all their milestones because they are not going to school. They live in dirt and filth and mud. And the look in their eyes, Andy, the look in their eyes, the photographs I've seen, that helpless, hopeless look that does not belong to a child. It does not belong on a child's face. It is terrible to see. And these children get no help whatsoever because those same broad-based black economic empowerment laws state that a company must only give charity to black charities because your charity giving must be on the same scale as the population of South Africa. And you get points deducted from your monthly scorecard if you give to white people. So the big supermarket chains, for instance, do not give anything to these white camps. In fact, you are barely able to register a white charity in South Africa because your charitable giving must be 80% black. So what hope is there for these people? Not much. And I want to tell you the story of one particular camp, which has had a lot of coverage, thank the Lord, in the world. But it is a terrible story. A bunch of white people lived at a place called Coronation Park, which was an abandoned caravan park in Gauteng. And they had grown vegetable gardens. They'd been there. They were established there for some time. Their living conditions were horrific, but they had banded together. They had gotten toilets. They had gotten running water. They had grown vegetables. It was a neat, tidy place. But the government decided that they wanted this particular piece of land for some reason best known to themselves. And after a seven-year court battle, the government won the case. But they had shot themselves in the foot with a law that they had brought out saying that if you evicted people from your land or your house, you then had to make sure that they had a place to go to. So they were then obliged by law to supply a place for these people to go. And they did this in such a nice manner. They took an unreconstituted garbage heap. And on top of this garbage heap, which they did not compact the soil, they did nothing. They put corrugated iron shacks with no foundations, no floors, just four walls, a roof, and one door. They had no windows, no nothing. And they moved these 300 people into this camp, which is one of the squatter camps so designated by the ANC government, one of the two. They moved these people in. No toilets, no running water, no electricity, nothing. Across the road from this camp is a black squatter camp built by the government. These people have indoor plumbing, they have electricity, they have running water, they have geysers, they have everything that is required to live in a sort of decent manner. So they build this white camp for the whites across the road from this black camp. And the first night that these people moved in, now you can imagine they don't have beds, they don't have furniture, so they have mattresses on this garbage pile, and you know what that consists of. The night they moved in, there was the most terrible storm, which blew some of the houses two blocks down the road. And the rain just poured in through the holes in the roof. So these people, the elderly, the children, and the others, were hip deep in floating garbage. Medical waste, condoms, tins, everything that goes into a garbage heap, they were in this. So a charity in South Africa, one that I support with everything I own and everything I believe in, South African Family Relief Project, they stepped in, seeing the plight of these people, and said, we would like to do something to make their lives a little easier. Well, they applied to the government to put foundations and decent houses up, and the government said, no, you cannot do that, because these have to be temporary housing, because we will move these people wherever we like, whenever we like. So you cannot put up permanent structures on this garbage heap. Anyway, they poured concrete floors, and they got porta potties. They hired porta potties for these people, and they got a generator, and they got, there were three taps of water for 300 people. Three taps provided by the government. They provided more. They provided a means to heat water. They put up a structure for a school. They built a retaining wall, because when it rained, the water that ran off from the black squatter camp just poured through this place called Mansiwal, poured through there and flooded the houses. So they put up a retaining wall to stop this water coming in. Now, to get to this camp, you have to go through the black camp. And the blacks saw that white people in their own pickups were bringing donations of blankets and furniture and stuff to this white squatter camp. So what they did was they'd have people walk slowly in front of the pickup while their friends took whatever was on the back of the pickup off. So by the time you got to the white camp, you had nothing left to donate to them. And if you did get through with food donations, when the whites were lining up to get their food, the blacks would join the queue and demand that they got their share as well. So it's an impossible situation to help these white people in South Africa without the blacks jumping on the bandwagon and taking the lion's share of it. This same camp, one night the black squatter camp rose up and got fed up and were rioting and protesting in the streets and decided to attack the white camp. And they came in numbers. So it was so funny. I'm in the United States, and I get this emergency call from a friend of mine saying, we need help at Munseyville. The blacks are going to attack us. We need to take the children out of there because the adults don't want to leave, because the minute they leave their homes, the blacks will then squat in them, and they will never get back into their homes. So I made a dozen frantic calls and got a whole bunch of charities together, and they had to go through the bush on the opposite side of the camp in the middle of the night, escort these children through the bush to their cars and take them to safety. Now, the next morning, Jan Lamprecht, who you know, went to do a tour of these camps, and he did a video of what the camp looked like after the blacks had been through it. And the porta potties that we had hired for this camp are made of green plastic. And every so often down the road, you would just see a puddle of melted green plastic where the blacks had burnt the porta potties to the ground. Anyway, about 3 days later, peace was restored and the children were taken back. But it just paints you a picture of how there isn't really even safety in numbers. There isn't safety in living in a place that the government have designated as a fit place for white people to live. It doesn't it just make sense of what the blacks think of us, that the government thinks that a garbage heap is the right place for white South Africans to live.
Exactly. I mean, your account, Karen, it's very disturbing, but I'm so pleased with everything that you've run through of the past and the present. It's absolutely shocking, but this is one of the best presentations I've ever heard on South Africa, and I thank you so much for taking the time to do it. Another point I want to throw in is, not to take off point, but this is just a comment by myself, is the ANC members like Albie Sachs and Joe Slovo, who were alongside Nelson Mandela, that were Jewish. And we see Jewish organisations throughout Europe trying to push refugees, well, into not just Europe, any white country that they can, and then elevate them above the white populations through the same sort of affirmative action that you've spoken about, prioritising them for every sort of benefit. They know that they breed more than the whites do, and it seems like a worldwide attempt to literally eradicate the white race from this planet, which their professors like Noel Ignatieff have admitted they want to do. So I'm just going to throw that in there. And now we've got, and as I said before, we can overrun if necessary. If there's nothing else that you have for us for the present, I understand that there are two forms that the, well, two paths rather, let me get the terminology right, two paths that the future could take for South Africa. So feel free to carry on with anything else that you want to talk about in the present, or if you're ready to, then please take us into the two paths of the future.
I just want to spend 5 minutes on the murders, because we haven't gone there, and it's a very important factor.
That's important, yeah, go ahead.
And I haven't spoken about that yet. So, there have been an incredible number of murders of white people in South Africa since 1994. The number that we have today is 85,000 white people. Now, a murder by these savages in South Africa is not a drive-by shooting. It is, they invade your home, they wait for you to come home, they tie up the father, they've been known to cut his eyelids off so he can't close his eyes to and not watch what's happening to his family. They rape the women and children with broken bottles, with sharpened broomsticks. They burn them with burning oil. They took a 74-year-old woman recently and drilled holes in her legs with an electric drill until she bled to death. They have drowned children in boiling water. They do the most horrific, barbaric, dreadful things to these people. And then they leave, taking a cell phone with them. So it is not a burglary. As the government says, it's a burglary gone wrong. It is not. It is a torture session which gives them great pleasure. And they like to leave the father alive so that he can know that he has no power as a white man, and they can come back anytime and do it again. And they attack in groups no smaller than four, but often as many as eight, and say six of them will go and attack an 86-year-old bedridden woman, rape her. It is just so beyond anything that people, that humanity would do. And it is beyond my understanding why the world is turning a total blind eye to this desperate situation. I don't understand it, but that's how it is. So the new laws say that they are going to, in the past, they could come and claim your farm from you. If some black person said that my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather grazed a goat here once, then he has a claim to your farm, and they can take it away from you, but they had to pay you fair value. The new law says that they can take it away from you without compensation. And this law does not apply only to farms. It applies to your residence. It applies to your business. It applies to anything owned by white people. They can come and take it away without any compensation whatsoever. Now, that law at the moment is held up in the courts, and the black groups like Economic Freedom Fighters, Black Land First, and the ANC are fed up that this land redistribution is not going as quickly as they want it. So they have said that on the 31st of December this year, by any means necessary, they are going to come for the whites' possessions. So it became very important and very urgent that something was done to save the white population of South Africa. Now, this is where I started. The only people with an internationally accepted claim to land up to the Fish River, which is almost the entire Cape, are the Khoisan people, because they have been designated by the United Nations as the first nation of South Africa, which makes the white people the second nation. So, a deputation of white people went to the Khoisan king and said to him, "Your people are not even accepted as people by this ANC government. You have no voice in government. You have no rights, according to them. Your people are suffering as much, if not worse, than the whites in South Africa. So why do we not band together? There are 4 million of you and 4 million of us. If we band together, we can secede under international law, claim the land that is yours and that the ANC government refused to give you, and form a nation of our own." And the Khoi king agreed. Now, this is a huge thing that has happened in South Africa that no one's paying attention to South Africa. So why I expected them to pay attention to this, I don't know. On the 24th of September of this year, the Khoi king, King Gubaha Cornelius III, stood up in front of the castle in Cape Town, planted his staff in the ground, and claimed that land on behalf of the four nations. The four nations are the Khoisan people, the Coloured Peoples, the Boer Nation, and the Anglo Nation. Now, the Boer Nation are Afrikaans-speaking South Africans, and the Anglo Nation are all other white South Africans. He claimed it on behalf of all of them. They signed a treaty setting up a parliamentary system under a sovereign, as you have in the UK. The Queen has duties, and the Parliament is under her, which is run supposedly by the people for the people. Now, in each parliamentary position, there will be a representative from each nation. In order to make this parliament transparent and unable to be sold out, each of the nations has an equal voice in every position in parliament. And the king signed a treaty with the four nations to make this happen. He then sent a letter of secession to the ANC government, to the EFF, to Blackland First, to all of the parliament, the people who have a say in the current ANC parliament. To date, and it's almost a month later, there's not even been an acknowledgement, never mind any blowback from any of these people. I think they are hoping that if they ignore it for long enough, it'll just go away. But it is not going to go away, because according to international law, it's a done deal. What they need to do now is to prove that they can govern. So what they're doing at the moment is putting a shadow government in place. We're calling it a shadow government because they have not been voted in. They are being put in a position so that we can prove to the world that this country can be governed properly. They're putting that in place. They're putting all the laws in place. They are formulating, excuse me, a constitution. And then we need one or more countries to acknowledge them as a nation. And then they can go to the United Nations, state their case, be acknowledged by the United Nations, have their flag fly with all the other nations of the world, and it's a done deal. There will be a country, a safe country, for the whites. That means they do not have to seek refugee status in some unfriendly country in the rest of the world, which so far has refused to grant them refugee status. Now, that is the best case scenario that I can see for South African whites in the future.
And Karen, what is the name of that country? Is it the Cape of Good Hope? Has it actually got a name?
It's the Sovereign State of Good Hope.
That's, thank you.
Is the name of it. Because Cape Town was the Horn of Africa was originally the Cape of Good Hope. And it just seems like the right name to give people good hope. It's a perfect name. So the only other way that I see this working out, and it has been stated by many people with way more brains and university degrees than I have, that if things continue down the same path in South Africa, there will be not one white left there by 2040. I think that's a little bit optimistic to spread it to 2040, but that is the foreseeable outcome, that the whites will be slaughtered wholesale starting on the 31st of December of this year. And there will be no whites to worry about. You will wake up one morning and ask yourself, where have the whites of South Africa gone? And then it's too late. And we have seen that the world has turned their back on South Africa since 1994. You hear nothing about South Africa in the news anywhere in the world. So unless they do this for themselves, there is no future for them. And I sincerely pray and wish and hope and with every fiber of my being that white South Africans can forget their petty differences, stand together with one strength and voice and make this happen or they are done for. And that is my story, Andy.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. And for the benefit of people listening in South Africa, how easy is it to literally up sticks now and travel to the sovereign state of Good Hope and set up home there in readiness for the protection that this state could offer them, as opposed to the fact that they're looking to lose their homes at the end of the year?
Well, Andy, you know, that's a decision that people have to make. I know, having left South Africa with nothing and come to the United States, how hard it is to give up everything you've worked for all your life and turn your back on it and walk away. It is not an easy thing to do, to go and face an uncertain future. But is it not better to begin again than to know that you are going to be slaughtered in the most barbarous fashion because your skin is white? Now, I know that it is not easy to walk away, but I also know that when you know for sure that your life and your children's lives and your grandchildren's lives are worth nothing where you are today, is it not better to pack your goods and go somewhere where you may have a safe future? It's a risk you are taking, but it is a greater risk to stay than it is to go.
I agree. And before we do go, Karen, could you please give the listeners details of Lee's website where people can donate to help these white people that are stuck in these settlement camps, and also your details again, your website, your radio show, etc., please?
Absolutely. Lee Oxley de Pryor is the CEO, as one would call her, of the South African Family Relief Project. It is www.sforsugar.org. You can donate on their website. They have all their projects up there. You can choose which project you want to donate to. Or if it's easier for you, you can go to radiofreesouthafrica.com. There is a donate button up there. All you need to put is that it's for the whites in South Africa, and the money goes straight there. Because I also help people who want to escape from South Africa. I help them with airfare. I help them with legal fees once they get to where they're going. And so my donate button helps those people as well. So you need to put what it is for. I assure you that South African Family Relief Project, their people are all volunteers. They do not take salaries. They do not take a penny for themselves. They use every cent that you give, they use for the white South Africans. The only money taken out of that is for the petrol for their deliveries, and that's it.
Thank you so much, Karen. That was one of the best shows I've ever recorded. Folks, what Karen's talking about in South Africa, this is coming to all white nations at breakneck speed. This is what all the immigration is all about. This is what all the affirmative action laws are all about. They're just a few years, if not months, ahead of us. So it's a cautionary tale, folks, but it's time to help the people suffering in South Africa, and also look to your own future and look to your own countries, see what's happening to them, and see the future that you're going to face if you do not tackle the enemy now. So I want to thank Karen so much for joining me today. I want to thank everybody for listening. I'll be back with you all soon, and bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.